We're going to start on time today. I was lightly chastised on the floor yesterday that I was starting a minute or two late. Unfortunately, that individual's not here right now, but we're going to get started. Because we don't have a quorum, what we'll do is we'll have the presentation of the bills, and as soon as we have a quorum, we'll then be able to make some motions. Members, we're going to do like we did at our last meeting. The Senate has passed the Senate file of the Judiciary Finance Omnibus Bill, so we will be moving the two House files onto the Senate file today. And so with that, Representative Cornish, welcome to the committee if you'd like to go over your bill. And again, once we have a quorum here, we'll officially get started.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'd like to go over House File 853. And as you know, or if you don't, Public Safety Policy and Finance has the purview over the following accounts. Public Safety, the BCA, Fire Marshal, Gambling and Alcohol Enforcement, Office of Justice Programs, the Armor System, Peace Officers Board or Post, Private Detective Board, Human Rights, and our big one, Corrections, which includes the institutions and community services and operations support. Now, we got a target of $1,025,818, and we did our target, and here's how we came to it. The we took money from the funding from the Office of Justice Programs, OJP, $6 million a year, about $12 million for the biennium. I'll just run through what we did, and then I'd be glad to come back and get into specifics in each account or withdrawal or transfer, whatever you would call it. And the next one is the fire safety account. We transferred $8.5 million of that to the general fund. The armor system, it was $2.6 million each year to the general fund. The human rights department, we cut 65% of that funding. Short-term offenders, we transferred there. You probably remember the when we did this before, it was 180 days, short-term offenders, those that are sent from the county jails to the state institutions. We moved that back to 60 days. The disaster assistance match, we're only doing the state share, and not the local government match. We do have fees in here, but the fees are on the prisoners. We increased the copay from $3 to $5 on the prisoner's medical care copay. The post board, our peace officer standards of training, we cut approximately $58 per officer statewide out of the officer training reimbursement account. And then when we go over the bill, we got several policy items, efficiencies with riders, probation revocation variance thing, a repat, talk about sending illegal aliens back to their country out of our jails, saving us some money, some compliance credit for the corrections where they can go over prisoners that are getting compliance credit to let them out of the facilities a little early, save us some money, and then the possibility of closing one of the juvenile facilities in the state, and various things like that we've done. Though we've cut into some of these accounts, we've given them ideas or things to study over the next 2 years that might take care of some of their needs or where they have to cut to meet their lack of funding given to them by us. With that, I'd be glad to answer any questions about any of the specific accounts and why we did what we did. And when we get a quorum, I've got the A1 amendment I'd like to offer. So.
All right, members, we do have a quorum, so I'll officially call the meeting to order. Representative Lanning moves the minutes of the March 28th meeting. Are there any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, nay. The minutes are approved. The next item on our agenda is to consider Senate File 958. I'll move Senate File 958 for consideration by the committee, and again, for those of you that came in a little late, we'll be amending the two House files onto the Senate file before we move the Senate file to the floor, inserting the House language, I should say. At this point, are there any questions for the bill author? Representative Champion.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Representative Cornish, I was listening to your presentation this morning talking about the various cuts that that you had to make in order to meet your target. And I thought about the importance of cuts, and I think about how potential cuts impact the work that organizations need to do. You so eloquently articulated that you cut the Department of Human Rights by 65%. And when I think in terms of the work of the Department of Human Rights, I think about the whole reason for a civil rights department. When we think about discrimination, when we think about protected classes that have had a history of being discriminated against, and that there's this mechanism in place by which to reassure those who feel as if they've been discriminated against or allege that there's some actions or conduct of an individual or an organization that has proved challenging. And so when I think about that, I think about the impact of the cut. So can you be so kind as to tell us why you felt it was important to gouge this organization by 65% and what you believe the impact of that cut will be on this organization and their ability to do the great work that they need to do in order to make sure all of our lives are improved?
Chair Cornish.
Madam Chair and Representative Champion, yes, I will, but I think you're wrong on two counts. First of all, we didn't gouge them. We reduced their budget. Secondly, their mission actually isn't just human rights and discrimination. I think you should enlarge your area of what they cover, because that's really not their biggest mission. Looking through their cases, factually, it seemed like that was one of their side missions, and they've kind of lost their primary mission. They spent more time, it seemed like, almost like the PCA, looking for trouble with the 65% of their money spent on education and outreach, going out and distributing literature and telling businesses how they could sue their employer. And that troubled some of us, and there were some kind of goofy cases that they were investigating. And give you an idea, the one employee got in an argument with his wife in the parking lot, and he ended up firing the person, and they called that a marital status complaint. I didn't think that had anything to do with marital status. It looked more like a marital argument. And there was a number of other cases that were just troubling. Plus, they bragged about, like the PCA does, another problem, they bragged about their fines. I really have a problem with the way they set up their website. Instead of talking about getting along in education and outreach, they were bragging about how many fines they've issued, and they posted the biggest cases on there. It was almost like America's Most Wanted, where it disappointed me that they had that kind of education and outreach. Plus, the director, the new director, he's a nice guy, but they didn't respond well to our first request for information. It was one of the most least cooperative agents we had in our first request for information. Another thing is when we got them up, we had a bill. We have a number of series of bills that I was the chief author of to prepare our committee to effectuate a change in the overall omnibus bill. And one of them was on human rights, cutting at 65%. So they called up and asked if they were going to have a bill up, and I said yes. So we had the bill, and they never even showed up. I thought that was kind of rude. Not rude, but it showed that not a lot of care. And when Mr. Lindsay came in front of our committee, I asked him why they hadn't showed up with the bill so important, with everybody saying how important the mission of the Human Rights Department is. And he said he had a hard time being in more than one place at one time. And they got a number of staff over there. You would think with somebody with such an important mission, which it is, could have sent somebody in front of us. And they did do a real good job of answering the questions, and it was just felt that the overall, we wanted to change their direction. So how we started that out was we changed their direction statutorily. Instead of education and outreach, they admitted it was 65% of their job. We took those duties away, or basically said, spend your money on enforcement and the toll-free line and taking actual enforcement complaints and work on that and not worry so much about the education and outreach. So we changed that. Well, to accommodate the commissioner's request, he came in front of us and said that they might not be eligible for some of the federal grants if we took away their education and outreach. So we put it back in per the request of the commissioner so that they would qualify, but we tied the funding. The state grants have to be used for enforcement, and the education and outreach is tied to the federal funding. And the final reason, I guess, is everybody on the DFL side of our committee, I don't mean to make this partisan, but told us what a huge important mission there was, and that they're at the tipping point. But yet, after 24 hours of deliberation, and we posted, you know, the meeting time, not one of the side came up with one fiscal amendment that would put money back in. Instead, they came up with a fiscal amendment that took money from the BCA and put it back into the retirement change that we had made. So, all in all, due to a lack of concern by the DFL members to really change the fiscal and the problems we had with the committee getting answers and the education and outreach being their main mission instead of enforcement, we cut them 65%, and I believe they cut 50% in the Senate. So it's a long answer to a short question.
No problem. Representative Cornish, I believe that my understanding of some of the work of the Human Rights Department is global. I also understand that this particular organization is responsible for compliance and monitoring for, contracts and making sure that if there's inclusion, that there truly is supposed to be, there really is supposed to be inclusion. And so I have this question. So did you decide to cut any other agency or budget by as much as 65%?
Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, Representative Campion, I don't believe so.
And did you
Representative Campion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you decide to also tie a funding stream to an organization only education or only compliance? So did you do that sort of narrow sort of approach with any other organization outside of the Department of Human Rights?
Madam Chair, Representative Campion, the only thing we came close to that probably was in OJP, where we gave direction. We did a 17% hit across the board, and then protected the women's shelters with an 11% cut. But other than that, I can't think of any specific direction.
Representative Campion.
So Representative Cornish, so it's fair to say that you did not see fit to cut any other agency by as much as 65%. You yourself talked about the broad work and mission of the Department of Human Rights. And you said that your understanding of the work goes beyond just compliance, or even just beyond, them making sure that people who have been historically discriminated against had a place or space by which to go, so any allegations can be investigated. So can you tell me what impact this 65% will have on a person from a protected class who goes to the Department of Human Rights as their last ditch effort by which to get redress, and how this 65% will affect the department's ability to investigate those claims?
Madam Chair,
Representative Cornish,
Representative Campion, give me a case, first of all, which human rights violation you talk about. You talk about race related, or you're talking about
religion.
Representative Champion.
I'm sorry.
Representative Cornish, you can want to finish religion. Your answer.
It could be religion. It could be gender. It could be based on race. Those are some of the issues that this department investigates. If somebody comes and says, I've been treated differently on my job from different from anyone else because of this reason. And so their work and their job is to now investigate that, use their power in order to investigate it, and to see if it rises to the level, the allegations rises to the level of probable cause. I want to know how that work can continue to go on with a 65% cut, and how you believe that will impact not only just the department, but the message that you send to the broader society.
Representative Cornish.
Well, it would help me, Madam Chair, and if you narrow down which complaint you're talking about, because if you're talking about it like a disability, there's different areas to go for that. EEOC, if you're talking about race, you can still go to the federal level and get a toll-free number there. And a federal human rights violation, you don't have to stay within the state. You could go to the courts. And so I don't think that, like you say, it's, what did you call it, last chance. There's a number of agencies you go to, EEOC, or if you live in St. Paul or Minneapolis or Duluth, and you can go to one of those. If you're outstate, you could call the toll-free number. I don't think actually it's going to diminish their mission as far as being able to effect a change or follow up on any violation.
Madam
Representative Champion.
Representative Cornish, did you have an opportunity to talk to anyone on the federal level to see if they have the capacity to now take over other potential cases that would have originally come to the state level? Did you get a chance to talk to anyone to see if, in fact, that the federal level would be able to accept these cases and really do a thorough job of making sure that they can, in fact, investigate them?
Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, Representative Captain, no, I didn't, because there's a number of states that don't even have a human rights department, and it sounds like they're doing okay, and I figured if the feds can take care of them, they could certainly take care of 35% of this one's mission. So.
Representative Champion.
So, Representative Cornish, did you call any of those other states in order to ask them how their civil rights issues are dealt with and whether the citizens really believe that they are getting a real opportunity by which to have their allegations addressed in real time, especially in light of the fact, so that's my question, especially in light of the fact that Minnesota and Hubert H. Humphrey was a real staunch supporter of civil rights. And so we being the state that he comes from, what sort of message does that send to our broader society if we take 65% out of the budget of the Department of Human Rights? And so it's a compound question, because I want to know, did you talk to any of those other states that you say they appear to be doing fine? I want to know what data that you have in order to really support that. And number two, I want to know your thoughts about the impact and the message that this sends, especially in a progressive state like Minnesota, when we think about the importance of all people being treated fairly and equitably.
Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, Representative Campion, first of all, no, I didn't call the other states. And secondly, we'll do just fine because the money is still there for enforcement. They were using 35% of the state money for enforcement. That 35% is still there. The 65%, other than that, they can turn and their education and outreach. I don't know if that'll stretch them on education and outreach, you know, and how they'll do in that funding. But our funding for enforcement is still there. So your question about people getting help on violations, and they call or show up there, they should be fine, in my opinion, anyway.
Madam Chair?
Representative Champion.
What was the department's reaction to it? Did the department say that we could do just fine with a 65% cut?
Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, Representative Champion, it's hard for me to gauge, you know, what his reaction was. I don't imagine, like anybody else, probably wasn't any happier than he was in the Senate when they cut it 50%. I really can't say, you know, he didn't seem all that upset. He did express concern about fulfilling the mission just like anybody would in any of the agencies we cut.
Just a couple more questions,
Representative
Chair, and I know that we have to go on. Did you ask him, as the chair of public safety, what the impact of the 65% cut will have on his ability to fulfill his mission on behalf of the state of Minnesota?
Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, Representative Campion, no, that question was asked a number of times by other people. I didn't have to ask. I usually at the committee ask most of the questions. So, but they did ask him, and he did express concern. And he asked for help with the language, and we gave it to him.
And so,
Representative
Madam
Campion.
Chair, so, Representative Cornish, I've heard you on a number of occasions during your testimony this morning say that they still have the ability to do enforcement. So can you tell me what you mean by enforcement and what enforcement the department will still be able to do?
Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, Representative Campion, I'm not an expert on the type of complaints they get. We did have a long laundry list of different complaints, and I looked at their website. But I imagine enforcement, if there was, like you were worried about, a civil rights violation of some type, and it can be many, whether it's an outright racial attack, whether it's prohibiting from getting a job, whether it's you're denied housing because you're black or Indian, those situations can still go on. That's three examples there, I guess. So if you're looking for more, I guess I'd have to go to the website.
Lastly,
Representative Campion.
Madam Chair, you understand that the work of the Department of Human Rights expands beyond just the notion of just race. You understand that it's also for gender. You understand it's for a number of different protections or support that this particular department does. Now, you also indicated earlier in your testimony that you realized that the department was doing a lot of educating. You said that you believe that roughly 65% of their work was around educating the public, and you believe that they had gotten off track from their mission because they were attempting to educate employers in the state of Minnesota or our residents around what they should or should not do. Are you suggesting to this committee that educating the broader public is not a part of the mission of any organization or state agency as a means to deter violations of any of our state laws or federal laws?
Madam Chair,
Representative Cornish, and then we're going to move on to
Representative
Bernhardt.
Couldn't have done a worse job of butchering what I said. First of all, you brought up the race issue, not me. And I was the one who educated you and said that it was more than a race issue, and I listed all the other things. Now, you turn that back on me and ask me the question, and I had just started out trying to educate you on their mission. Now, what was the second part of your question?
Well, let me say,
Representative Campion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that you've done the worst job of trying to butcher what I said, because what I said to you is that this particular organization deals with historic discrimination, and I never said race. You brought up race.
Okay.
Historic discrimination.
Representative Campion, most of us in the room have had very little sleep, and that makes some of us cranky.
Okay.
So... if you could maybe wrap up here, part of what we need to do is get a committee report to the floor at least 4 hours before session starts. If we fail to do that, there's a really good chance we're going to have session on Friday and or Saturday. And so I'm trying to move things along. I think both of you have been pretty clear in your positions. I have at least two other people that have questions, and we have another bill to do. So if you could wrap up, I would appreciate that.
Madam Chair, I will wrap up. I will totally agree that I didn't get to bed until early this morning, like the rest of us, and had to leave very early in order to be in court this morning. So I'll wrap
and
up.
And
by
is that ending. Here? Or
I'm sorry?
Are you saying court's here?
Hey, I'm just trying to get to the bottom of this matter.
I understand that, Representative Campion.
And so so I understand that you said that I've done a good job of butchering what you were saying. And what I was merely indicating before I chatted briefly with our great chair is the fact that I talked about initially this organization being important around protecting classes from discrimination, and there's been historic information around folks who have been discriminated against. I didn't mention black, white. I said it could be a gender issue, it could be race. But what I will say, and my question was that you asked me, was whether you believe that, do you believe that it's important for a state agency as a part of its mission to educate the public and others around the issues that is within their sphere as a means of deterring potential violations and or equipping us with information that we need in order to improve our quality of life.
Representative Cornish, and then we're going to go to Representative Bernhardt, Westrum, and Carlson. Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, Representative Campion, I was very specific when Holly said how they got off track. I didn't have any problem with the education, but what they were, their form of education was bragging about violations on a website, putting a lot of minutia on there, didn't think it should be on there, and then almost it seemed like more than educate the public, as to what resources were available. They were trying to educate people and businesses on how to sue their employer. It just seemed to be, you'd have to look at the website to understand it was it was just different. And that's why I think they got off track. Instead of worrying about enforcement, which I thought was their primary mission, they were spending 65% of it on education.
Representative Reinhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cornish, I'd like to at least take a few minutes to look a little more carefully at the Office of Justice program cuts. As you can well imagine, I know you're very well aware of incidents that have occurred in our region of the state and the need for maybe additional funding in the area of particularly domestic abuse prevention. But I realize that relative to the overall cuts to the Office of Justice programs, you did do your best to protect, or what you perceived as your best to protect, domestic abuse shelters. But nevertheless, a cut of 11% in the times we are in, we know then difficult economic times, the need for those services rises, and we've been trying to do a better job in many of these areas. And, you know, as you can guess that I've heard from shelters in our area about the consequences to their ability to serve needy victims. So would you please address that?
Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, Representative Brenner, yes, I was. I was troubled by the Office of Justice programs. They could probably stand an audit in the near future. They spend $68 million in 2 years, and I'll just take a few minutes to go over this, but the battered women's shelters that we've protected 11%, I think that probably, even though it's hard to feel grateful at that kind of cut, California eliminated their domestic shelter, or their women's shelters here recently. Rhode Island cut 60% of the funding for women's shelters, and New York is over half of their funding for women's shelters. It seems like it's a thing that's happening now around the states when people are trying to find ways to cut. We cut them back to 11%, and I think their mission will go on with that. It might put a strain on them, but I don't think there'll be any more bad things happening because of 11% cut. Off of the justice programs overall, it's really troubling because it looks like that $68 million they get, there's 502 grants, and there's not a lot of accountability. And Mrs. Borg, well, I shouldn't state names here in testimony, but the director came before us and couldn't answer a lot of questions in a number of times, and I was hoping to bring somebody with him so we could get specific questions answered. But there's 502 grants out there. There's, I don't know, 240 programs, and it looks like they're taking a big pot of money and giving the same amount out to county attorneys' offices in different places. I mean, we see 43,000, 43,000, 43,000. It didn't matter if you're a big county or a little teeny county, you were getting the same amount of money. And the money was not being doled out, in my, once again, not an expert opinion, but, you know, I've only got so much time to look at these accounts and ask so many questions. But it doesn't look like they were doing a real stellar job of doling out the grants, even though they've got 40 people in the Office of Justice Programs and somebody in each category. They couldn't answer questions about certain organizations and how they were spending their money. Plus, some of the women's shelters had millions of dollars in reserve. And one of the women's shelters were paying their director $172,000 a year. I thought that was just a little crazy. And then they come up with the excuse that, well, we're not using any of your money to pay that salary. To me, that's a ridiculous argument, because if you're getting state and federal money, I mean, the more money they're paying her, the more they're going to have to ask us for help, because the federal money is going to run out at some point. So they just need a lot of work in the Office of Justice Programs, spending $68 million and 502 grants without a lot of accountability. And the women's shelters, I think, are going to be just fine with an 11% cut. The Office of Justice Programs has been cut in the last two bienniums. And the previous chair did protect women's shelters, but he had a minuscule budget deficit compared to this, and if I wouldn't put words in his mouth, but I bet you he would have cut if he would have had this deficit. So that's the best I can answer.
Representative Reinhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll just make an additional comment. I don't think we'll resolve this here. It does sound like you have some issues around performance for many aspects of the Office of Justice programs, but I would say you should fairly put the burden on individual recipients of the grant for some type of performance review without punishing all all shelters equally, and I think I could speak pretty strongly for my own community shelter. I know many people who've been involved over the last couple decades in the programming there. I think they would welcome an audit and a performance accountability approach, but they will suffer. Women in our community will suffer, and there will be more incidents of domestic violence that go unanswered because we're cutting these programs. So I see this as a very serious cut.
Representative Westrom.
Madam Chair, just briefly, Representative Reinhart, you can bring up another option or proposal to the table to restore these and reduce it somewhere else. Everyone's got that ability to bring those amendments forward. But Representative Cornish really addressed some of the same things that Representative Champion was talking about, but Representative Champion, he's right. As I understand the EEOC, they'll enforce if you don't have a state mechanism, and a lot of states don't even have an enforcement mechanism at the state level. So there probably is some duplication here, and probably still will be if we keep it in the enforcement arm.
Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, when we get to that point, by the way, I would like to request a roll call vote on the bill, but I...
And Representative Carlson, just for clarification purposes, at the end when we have it all put together, is that when you're asking for the roll call?
Well, I see there's an amendment in our packet, and I understand that's probably an amendment that there will be a fair amount of consensus on if it's the amendment I think it is.
Right.
So I'm talking about the final passage, unless there are other issues that surface.
Well, Representative Carlson, there'll be a number. There'll be four separate votes in that we have to move two different House files onto the Senate file, and we have an amendment and then final passage. So I'm just trying to clarify for you what roll call you'd like.
I speed along, and I was just, while you recognized me, I wanted to point out that on final passage of the bill, we're requesting a roll call.
Okay, thank you. Representative Carlson.
I'm not sure we'll be requesting any on the amendment or the others. But my question, Representative Cornish, deals with potential impact on property taxes, because they're requiring that short-term offenders be held in the county jails. And so that's a cost to our local units of government. And I'm not sure if you had a fiscal note on that, or if you could tell us, and virtually every bill that comes through, I'm asking if there's an impact on the property tax. So if you could tell us how you book that number, and if there is, in your view, going to be any impact on the property tax. And then also, while I have the floor, when you get to answering that question, there's also... And I've raised this question, and as my colleague to my right has on the House floor, the disaster assistance match with us moving into the flood season, it's my understanding that some of that could be used for flood relief, and that's a shift now onto local units of government as well. So if you could comment on those two.
Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, on the short-term offender, first of all, there's been, I'll just read you two short paragraphs here. There have been two professional studies done on short-term offenders. The gist of what I'm going to tell you here is that the county probably should be paying for short-term offenders. We found that they're sending people to state prison for a matter of a few weeks, a lot of them for under 60 days. It doesn't make any sense why people are sending people to state prison and expecting the state to pay for it. We've got kind of an inverse reverse mandate on the state. The first report I'll read from here is just, it won't take but a minute. It's a Brandel-Weber report in 1995, and it says, The state's criminal justice system is inefficiently organized. Funding for local entities is fragmented, making coordination and consistency nearly impossible. Today we have a distorted situation in which the locally funded components of the system, law enforcement and prosecution, determine what the state-funded components, courts, public defense, probation, and corrections, are obligated to process and pay. And their recommendation was incarcerate in county facility those offenders with short sentences. They recommend that all offenders with less than a year be housed locally and that the county pay for it. The second one was by Minnesota Planning in 1996. Their recommendation was shift short-term offenders to county jails. One option that would reduce costs and free up some prison beds would be to assign all short-term felony offenders, those less than 1 year of prison, to serve time that they are sentenced to county jails instead of state facilities. We've probably made ourselves believe when we hear this unfunded mandate, that this, some respects we think that the state should pay for everything. But what we're finding out is the county attorneys and the county courts are feeders of the system. Sending prisoners up to state facilities, we have no control over and don't know how many numbers are coming. We're just expected to pay for it. I think that the county should have some skin in the game and realize what they're doing, how they're feeding the system, and pay for it. To me, there doesn't make any sense as being law enforcement for 36 years to see counties sending prisoners and felons for less than 60 days or for a number of weeks. Also, in our efficiency studies, we've got a huge variance in counties as far as sending people up on probation revocations and expecting us to pay for it also. They sent them up for a few weeks for a technical violation, where one county might send a load of prisoners up, another one sends very few. So one of the things we've directed to do is a probation study and see if we can save some money if we by getting a uniform application of some of these things. So the short-term offenders, actually it's a savings to this, quite a bit to the state, even for 60 days. And I don't know if the fiscal analyst has anything on a local. We got any local on it? We did run a fiscal note, but I don't know if they come up with a local impact.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Carger, if you'll state your name for the record.
Gary Carger, fiscal analyst for the committee. And there was a fiscal note done, but it was done on the, at that time it was 180 days or less. And I think they just mentioned that there would be a local impact. They did not get into the numbers, but one number that we do have from that fiscal note was that prison admissions for 1 month or less, 447 for going into prison for 1 month or less.
And essentially that's what I was asking. I'm not interested with the limited time right now in getting heavily into the why of the change, but the question I was raising is what was the local impact and what the potential impact might be on property taxes. I understand what you're saying. You're saving the state dollars, but it does have a cost impact on local units of government. The other question is just a follow-up to Representative Champion's line of questioning. And I wonder, this is a request of the agency. My recollection is the relatively small agency, and I'm sure there's with that the magnitude of that cut, it's going to have an impact on minimally on the timeline with their investigations and so on. And I know a few years ago we were working very hard to eliminate the backlog of cases, and my concern is that with these cuts that we may again be developing a backlog of cases and a form of justice denied as a result of that. So my request is that maybe the department provide us with some information before we hit the House floor with the bill as to what the impact might be. It's not a large staff there, and with that kind of a cut, I'm sure, and they're here to hear the request. I know the time is probably tight right now to do that, but if they could get that to us.
Representative Carlson.
Other question I have, Representative Cornish referenced the fee, and we've discussed fees in here before and the law that says that a fee is a tax. And whether or not this bill should go to a tax committee. my question of you is, the rule is uses the word substantial. And Representative Solberg and I defined substantial at about $2,000. And some of you may remember that the constitutional amendment, for example, Secretary of State said that there would be a cost of about $2,000 to put that on the ballot. And we ran a pretty tight ship in that regard. And I guess my question of you, being that there is a fee in here, is how you're defining substantial.
I believe that this year we set a precedent with Representative Kahn's bill of the additional members of the Pension Commission, and I think the dollars were $3,000 on that.
That wasn't fee.
Representative Kahn?
Madam Chairman, there wasn't any fee on that.
No.
That was just, would be increases in per diem, so it was just things that would be absorbed.
I'm well aware of that, but what the question of Representative Carlson was defining the level of substantial,
yeah,
as far as spending.
As the rule says, a substantial impact on tax revenues or tax policies. And so we happen to use, if I recall correctly, $2,000. And what you're saying, at least relative to that bill, $3,000. But I think what did Representative Cornish say? This is at, what is it, $30,000? My copy here, $35,000, I guess. Each year, the biennium total.
Representative Carlson, would you tell us what page and line number you're referring to on the spreadsheet, please?
The spreadsheet, that's short-term offender. Wait a minute. Here it is. Inmate health co-pays, line 104 on the spreadsheet.
And Representative Carlson, if you go further in the House rules, it said for purposes of this paragraph, tax excludes any fee charge, exaction, or assessment, a primary purpose of which is to recover direct or indirect cost incurred by the state or other governmental entity or as a payment for benefits received. My understanding of this was for medical costs received
that's
by
what the testimony was,
the prisoner. So it's not my intent to send this bill to the tax committee. Representative Davis.
But for
Madam,
Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, for the future, then we're going to use a benchmark of 2,000 to 3,000. Is that kind of where we're at then? You referenced 3,000.
Yeah, Representative Carlson, we had this, not you and I, but there was a conversation offline relative to the $2,000 threshold and the Kahn bill. And the decision whether or not to let the Kahn bill on the pensions go to the floor with the $3,000 amount or not. And I made the decision, nobody on your side of the aisle objected when that bill went through to that. And so, that's a benchmark that's been set this session. So
just so we understand what the ground rules are relative to the amount. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I think that...
I'm sorry. Representative Davis, did you want to weigh in on the Carlson question?
And
my apologies, Representative Hornstein.
House rules, and clearly this bill does not need to come to taxes. Earlier in the week with the Economic Development Bill, in my mind, clearly that did need to come to taxes, and we'll be hearing that at 12. This one clearly does not need to come to taxes.
Right, thank you.
And
Representative Carlson.
I didn't make the motion to do that.
I understand.
Just one clarification.
I understand. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I think Representative Champion, I think, very clearly laid out the problems with the budget aspect of this bill. I mean, he's absolutely right. This is a very, very deep cut, which I think will have, profound impact on the agency. But, in Article 2, there's some policy issues that I think we ought to be looking at. And beginning on line on page 13, line 4 and 5, for example, they delete having a St. Paul office and other branch offices. And it sounded like Representative Cornish, when Representative Champion was discussing these cuts with you, you said, well, you know, they can just call an 800 number and, at the federal government. I mean, I don't think that that's going to really be a message we want to send in terms of how much we prioritize this. I mean, a branch office in a local community versus an 800 number in Washington somewhere, I think the result of this policy is to make this agency very inaccessible to citizens. But, you know, I have an additional concern about lines 33, beginning with lines 33, where there's talk about, well, they'll still be able to do compliance. But then why delete developing programs that will aid in determining compliance? So it's a real mixed message, and I think overall, you know, the message is to people that care about human and civil rights in the state is that this is not just we're not going to prioritize this for funding, but we're also going to gut the policy. So I don't know, Representative Cornish, if you have any comments on some of these policy concerns, but I think they're as profound as the budget acts that you've put to this agency.
Representative Cornish, we're here mainly for the financial components of the bill, and we're running out of time as far as not having a session on Friday or Saturday, so I think we'll take your comments. I'm sure that Representative Cornish would be happy to have a conversation on the policy issues with you, Representative Hornstein, as both your schedules allow. Representative Kahn.
I just wanted to respond to Representative Cornish's statements of listing all the states that were cutting battered women's shelters. Minnesota was the first state in the country to set up battered women's shelters, and so I think it's really offensive that we should even look at other states as an example.
Thank you, Representative Kahn. Representative House.
I'm going to pass.
Representative Rukavina.
Saturday looks good and all, but anyway. Madam Chair and Representative Cornish, what are you exactly, do you have any estimates on what your shift to the county jail system is going to cost the counties?
Representative Rukavina, we did discuss that prior to your arrival today.
Important.
We also discussed the fact that many of us haven't had much sleep and are a little cranky, and we do have time constraints, so... If Mr. Carger wants to briefly address that,
asked by the committee, I'll get that later. But my point being, I thought we didn't have a revenue problem; we had a spending problem. That's what everybody's been saying. So, why do the counties have to spend their revenue taking care of state prisoners if we don't have a spending problem?
Representative Cornish, very briefly.
Yeah, well, Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, we did have a good conversation that before or today, and basically I think we probably disagree on whose prisoners they are. They come from the county, and the county prosecutor and the county judge, and the two studies that I referenced kind of indicated that the county shouldn't just think that they're the state prisoners, ship them up there. We have problems with sending them up for a few weeks, and 400 and some of them for less than...
30 days?
For less than 30 days. So the county's been sending these people up for less than 30 days, numbers of them. It costs the state a lot of money and doesn't seem to do a lot of good. And we've got a study within to look at that problem, why there's a variance from county to county. But the remark was made that the county should have some skin in the game, too. And the short-term offenders is a real problem. Even corrections admits that.
Well,
Representative Rukavina.
Madam Chair, please... correct me if I'm wrong. Are there still county courts? I thought all the courts were state courts. Huh?
What's that?
Are there still county courts in Minnesota?
Representative Cornish.
Madam Chair, I don't believe so. I don't think they're called district
courts. Well, you said the county courts send them.
Representative Rukavina.
Madam Chair, you said the county courts send them up. Well, they're state courts, and they are enforcing state law, almost all of which I never voted for, I might add, Madam Chair, because I voted against every crime bill but omnibus crime bill but one. So, you know, you're the ones putting the pressure on the county courts when you pass these laws, and, you know, we got police officers and lawyers that got a lot of skin in the game passing laws, and everything's illegal. I think what I'm doing right now is illegal, Madam Chair. I may go to jail for this, the way you're looking at me, but Okay, I pass.
Thank you, Representative Rukina. All right, members, what I'd like to do at this time is we have Senate File 958 in front of the committee. I would like to insert the language of House File 853, the first engrossment, into Senate File 958, and then we will take up the A-12 amendment.
Oh, you liberals.
So, members, all those in favor of inserting House File 853 into Senate File 958, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion's adopted. The amendment is approved. Next is Amendment A-12. This amendment would delete that portion of the bill. The emails call it CREP. I'm sorry that I don't know what stands for, but it's really a pension issue, and it's my understanding that this issue will be brought before the Pension Commission this session for discussion. Is that correct, Representative Cornish?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
All right. So, members, any question on the A-12 amendment? Representative Westrom?
So, Madam Chair, we're taking this savings out of the bill. Is that, and about how much does it affect the bill?
Representative Cornish?
Madam Chair, Representative Westrom, it turned not to be a savings. It turned out to be a cost. That's what we're taking it out. The figures that came back from the MSRS said it would be a savings, and then they come back with a number of other figures later on that it would be a cost. And we did have it checked out by the actuary, Mercer, and also the pension retirement folks, and it ended up to being a cost for a number of about 8 pages of reasons here that we probably couldn't get into today to take up the rest of the hour, but it's a cost instead of a savings. So.
All right. Members, all those in favor of the A-12 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The A-12 amendment is adopted. Members, if there's no other questions on the public safety portion of this bill, I would like to move on to the judiciary, which is the House File 440. Representative Smith, if you want to step to the stand. Thank you, Representative Cornish. Representative Smith, if you'd like to briefly go over the financial components of House File 440 for the committee, please.
Madam Chair, thank you. Also, I'd like to first ask a question. I know a couple of days ago you announced that today there would be a marriage ceremony in this committee today. Do I still have time to go get an antenuptial contract with my soon-to-be mate, Representative Cornish?
Well, Representative Smith, I hope that nobody bought any wedding gifts, because I'm not sure you got married anymore here. I think you're actually being amended onto another bill. So at the time we talked about a marriage, we thought the both of you were going to go on the same House File. But now that we have a Senate File, I'm not sure what you would call that, so I'm just not going to go there. But Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, thank you for that admonition. The question is withdrawn. Madam Chair and members, the Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee was given a target by this committee, and we met our target while meeting what I believe are the priorities in funding core government functions and essential services. Our total general fund spending for fiscal years 2012 through 2013 will be less than the current general fund expenditures approved by the previous legislature for fiscal years 2010 through 2011 by around $6 million. Being spared any additional reductions to the projected baseline, we could have taken the easy route in the Judiciary Committee and just put into place the existing numbers. Yet the responsibility of our fiscal committees goes well beyond simply filling numbers into a spreadsheet. They were not easy decisions, but our task and our responsibility was to put the resources we have on the table to their best and most appropriate use to serve the best interests of all our citizens who rely on our judicial system, the third branch of government, for safety and security of their neighborhoods, the protection of their rights, and the faithful administration of justice. To that end, Madam Chair, the fiscal accounts under the jurisdiction of the Judiciary Policy and Finance Committee were funded as follows. in relation to the projected baseline budget for 2012 through 2013, the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, and the district courts received a 1.2% increase. The Public Defense Board, Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and the Tax Court are held constant at their projected baseline. The Guardian Ad Litem Board is reduced 3.8%. Civil Legal Services is reduced 16.9%. And the Uniform Laws Commission is reduced 38.8%. At this point, Madam Chair, I would ask the fiscal analysis to maybe go through the spreadsheet at this time.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. If you'll state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Emily Adrians, and I'm with the House Fiscal Staff. I hope that you all have a copy of the spreadsheet, and I will just point out the changes that were made by the committee. The increases that the chair pointed out for the Supreme Court is on line 7, and the biennial increase for 2012 and 13 is just short of $500,000. For Civil Legal Services, which is on line 14, the reduction for the biennium there is $4 million. On line 24 for the Court of Appeals, the increase is almost $200,000. Under the trial courts or the district courts, on lines 33 and 34 are the changes. The $150,000 in savings was the result of House File 440, of course, before it became the omnibus bill. There was a change in statute clarifying where the placement of license plates on cars, and there was also a change in proof of insurance, who could collect that. And so there was savings if the court administrator can collect the proof of insurance versus a judge or a prosecutor being involved, that saved some money for the trial courts. And then the increase for the biennium, just over $6 million. On line 42 under the Guardian Ad Litem Board, this is their 3.8% reduction. That's just over $750,000. If you'll turn to page 2. For the Uniform Laws Commission on line 57, the reduction is $38,000 for the biennium. For the Board of Judicial Standards on line 65, an increase of $14,000 annually, which is $28,000 for the biennium. And then there were a couple of revenue adjustments made, and that's starting on line 85. The bill allows the court authority to seek partial payments for these IFP waivers. This was in House File 1023. And this generates savings to the general fund for the biennium of $1.8 million. And this was used to help offset some of the increases that were given to the courts. And then there was also an increase in penalty assessments in House File 556. This goes into a special revenue fund, and the total is $92,000 for the biennium. It doesn't go toward the bottom line on the spreadsheet since it goes to this special revenue fund. There's language in there distributing the additional revenue, and it's a pass-through, and so some of it goes to the Department of Public Safety, and some of it could go to local county officials. And that is everything, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Chair Smith, do you have anything that you'd like to add? Otherwise, we can go to questions.
Madam Chair, I do not. We'll go to questions.
All right, thank you. Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, my question is somewhat similar to what I asked about the Department of Human Rights, because I see the impact here on Civil Legal Services is very substantial as well. And Representative Smith could share with us what he sees as the impact, and maybe even on this one, and if we could even get a quick comment from maybe the Department of Human Services as well, if we could have representatives just come forward and give us a quick take on what these reductions mean. And I would understand they have to be brief because you'd have to get the bill out.
Chair Smith, would you like to explain your change item on Civil Legal Services?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Carlson, the bill contains language and I'll just try to respond, and I hope it answers, but the legal services to low-income clients in family law matters, for example, we have rider language requested by civil legal services dating back to issues in providing equitable access to family law legal services by low-income women. We have language dealing with limits on services. The total state contribution to civil legal services accounts for about one-third of their funding. We do in this bill limit resources to make available for civil legal services, and those limited resources should be focused on providing the legal services which relate to state civil legal matters. Nothing in this bill prohibits or restricts how non-state funds can be used.
And Chair Smith, did you have civil legal services testify in your committee on this issue?
Madam Chair, yes.
All right. Representative Carlson, I think given that we have like about 30 seconds to get this bill to the revisor's office, and the fact that the committee did do their work and heard from these organizations, historically in Ways and Means, we don't take testimony from the public, and there's some kind of change.
I'm trying to respect your time.
Or a need for a phone a friend, and I'd like to stick to that because we could spend a lot of time on a lot of bills.
Madam Chair, if I may, I wasn't requesting testimony per se, but just that they answer a couple of questions. But I'll try to respect your time, but these questions, and I think, will have to be addressed on the House floor, because I think they're important, quite frankly, and I wasn't trying to get into the policy right now as much as I was the numbers, but quite frankly, it looks to me like it's almost punitive as I read what is happening here, but we can save that discussion in for the House floor, because I understand you want to merge the bills. But I would recommend after they're merged and when we get to the final vote, a no vote.
All right, thank you, and I appreciate your assistance with this. Representative Hornstein.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And quickly, I mean, I do think the civil legal services cut is very, very significant at 17%. I had a visit from a judge, and we talked about this, and she said, you know, this is really delaying all kinds of trials and cases, and it clogs up the courts, and it's just, I think there's broad consensus that we need to have, you know, this has to stop. And so I just want to just weigh in on the record and say this is very troubling, and I think it's just going to really create more backlog and more problems, not to mention lack of representation. And I don't know, Representative Smith, if you agree with that, but you know, this judge certainly was concerned about it.
Briefly, Chair Smith.
Madam Chair, we had a target to meet. The third branch receives about 1.2% of the entire state budget, which is minuscule for a branch that oversees our justice and our safety. Secondly, civil legal services of the line items that we have is not mandated by the Constitution or any statutory provisions like public defender is. Third, representatives, the funding is two-thirds non-state, one-third state. We do not attempt to restrict any non-state use of funding.
Thank you. Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Emily, help me walk through this here, because I'm not seeing a comparison to actual spending in 10 and 11. So, but maybe I'm missing it somewhere. Where? So the House actual spending after adjustment is way below line 88 there, whatever. It's 362. 387, 364, 429, right? On the back page? 362, 387, and 364, 429 are your recommendations. What's the actual spending in 10 and 11?
Madam Chair and Representative Rukavina, I apologize. I did not include the 10 and 11. I just have the governor 10 and 11. The total biennial for 10 and 11, I believe, was $734 million. So it was $734 million, and then the biennial base funding for 12 and 13 is $726
million.
Representative Rukavina.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a little bit of a cut, but most of it looks like, so that would be about an $8 million cut, if I'm not mistaken, or a little less than $8 million, and half of it, then, or over half, Representative Smith, is coming out of civil legal services. So we kind of took care of all the judges and everybody else, and then it looks like Guardian Ad Litem program took a cut too. Is there anything in this bill that freezes salaries for the court system, like the other all the other bills coming through are doing?
Madam
Chair Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, the history is this. For the past 2 years, the judiciary has self-limited its own salary increases. There's been a salary freeze. They negotiate that. They don't negotiate their health insurance costs. This bill recognizes an additional two-year freeze on the salary that we're asking for, and it terminates 2 years from the date. There was anti-collective bargaining language in the original bill, and at my request and the committee's agreement, we stripped that out.
So, Madam
Representative Rukavina,
Madam Chair, none of the other bargaining units, if you want to call them that, in the judiciary system aren't then getting hit with pension, new pension plans, or collective bargaining, things like that.
Madam Chair,
Chair Smith.
Rukavina, no.
Okay, and the judges themselves then will, the Supreme Court, I'm assuming the Chief Justices and that, will, or the Supreme Court Justices will have some kind of a policy where they're going to freeze their salaries for the next 2 years?
Chair Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative Rukavina, yes. Our intent was to recognize and extend the salary freeze, that if there was any additional money, throw it at employment, that it would be for adding back employees, not raising salaries.
Okay. Chair Smith moves to insert the language of House File 440, the first engrossment, into Senate File 958. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion's adopted. The last item is the roll call on Senate File. Let's see, where is it here? 958, so it contains the public safety omnibus bill with the amendment to remove the CREP program, the judiciary omnibus bill as presented to the committee, and there has been a request for a roll call. Representative Biskins.
Madam Chair, I think the Senate file is before us right now. The motion would be, Madam Chair.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I don't believe there's a motion on that yet. Is the motion to be sent to the General Register?
I'm sorry, Representative Biskins. I did move the Senate file at the very beginning of the meeting, so the motion would be to renew my motion that Senate file 958 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Mr. Smith will take the roll.
Representative Holberg.
Yes.
Representative Downey.
Aye.
Representative Carlson.
No.
Representative Abler.
Yes.
Representative Bruce Anderson.
Yes.
Representative Sarah Anderson.
Yes.
Representative Beard.
Aye.
Representative Breinart.
No.
Representative Biskins.
Aye.
Representative Champion.
No.
Representative Davids.
Yes.
Representative Eakin.
No.
Representative Garofalo. Representative Greiling. Representative Gunther.
Yes.
Representative Hackbarth.
Aye.
Representative Hamilton.
Yes.
Representative Hornstein.
No.
Representative Howes.
Yes.
Representative Huntley. Representative Kahn.
No.
Representative Kiffmeyer.
Aye.
Representative Lanning.
Yes.
Representative Lincheski.
No.
Representative McNamara.
Yes.
Representative Nornes.
Yes.
Representative Pulowski. Representative Rukavina.
No.
Representative Slawick.
No.
Representative Smith.
Yes.
Representative Wagenius. Representative Westrom.
Yes.
By a vote of 17 to 10, the motion prevails. The bill is on its way to the General Register. Thank you, Chair Smith, Chair Cornish, and committee members for getting here with very little sleep and recognizing our time constraints. If there's no other business, Representative Rukavina.
Madam Chair, you look great. You don't look cranky at all. I just want you to know that.
I appreciate that, Representative Rukavina.
Madam Chair, for your time and consideration, thank you.
Thank you, Chair Smith. The meeting's adjourned. Great.